So welcome back to Chew On This. Today we're tackling a threat that is hiding in plain sight, one that's invisible, pervasive, and increasingly devastating to the food industry. Our debate today is titled, When the Threat Isn't Physical, Are We Taking Cybersecurity Seriously Enough? We've become experts in the food industry at managing the physical, chemical, allergenic, and microbiological hazards through well-established HACCP plans that are validated, implemented, verified, and continually developed and reviewed. It has been a legal requirement in the UK since 2006 to implement a HACCP-based food safety management system when EU regulation EC 852/2004 came into effect. But while HACCP has given us decades of maturity in managing traditional food safety risks, the landscape of threats has shifted. Increasingly, the most dangerous hazards aren't physical at all, they're digital. Cyber attacks don't just threaten data, they can bring production lines to a halt, disrupt logistics, paralyze distribution networks, and ultimately jeopardize food availability. In a sector that produces, moves, and sells millions of products every day, a single breach can cascade across the entire supply chain. Unlike a contaminated batch of product, you can't quarantine a cyber threat. It moves faster than any recall, and the consequence can run into the hundreds of millions. In more recent years, we've seen frameworks like TASAP and VASAP introduced to expand our focus beyond food safety into food defence, protecting our products and supply chains from intentional harm, whether through malicious contamination, fraud, or sabotage. But as our industry becomes increasingly digitalised, cybersecurity now sits firmly within this space. Protection systems, recipe data, supplier networks, and even retail ordering platforms are interconnected, and that connectivity brings vulnerability. Yet in many businesses, responsibility for these emerging threats has defaulted into technical or food safety teams who are experts in HACCP, but not necessarily in defending against ransomware, phishing, or supply chain attacks. The question we need to ask is, are we truly set up to protect our businesses and our consumers from a digital threat landscape that is evolving faster than we are? This is why we've brought together today's panel to unpack what these rising threats mean for our industry, to explore where the biggest vulnerabilities lie, and to discuss how we can better defend ourselves in a rapidly evolving digital landscape. Today, I'm joined by Soraya and Ben, and I will hand over to you, Soraya, to kick off introductions.
Hi, thank you, Emily. So I'm Soraya Beardmore. I am Oscar Meyer, doing HRIS project implementations. My background's predominantly in several different industries. So this is the first time I've worked in the food industry, and it's very technical. So hopefully I won't bore you with too much technical jargon, but I'll try and make it as nice and simple as possible.
Cheers. And I'm Ben Pye. So I'm from the Food Standards Agency's National Food Crime Unit, and I look after our prevention and relationship management team, working predominantly with industry on how to promote fraud prevention advice in the food sector, make sure that companies are protected adequately. My background is food safety. So I started out training as an environmental health officer, then spent time as a QA and technical manager and supplier auditor. And so done a bit of everything in the kind of a food safety area. And then for the last 18 months, I've been back to working with businesses. So using kind of my knowledge of the industry to help businesses, and we're trying to promote just a good level of vulnerability assessment in businesses against food fraud.
Thank you very much. So in April 2025, a wave of coordinated ransomware attacks hit some of the UK's biggest retailers, with Marks & Spencer and the Co-op among those directly impacted. The Cyber Monitoring Centre classified the event as a Category 2 systematic incident, placing it amongst the most severe national-level cyber events in recent years. Combined losses are estimated to sit between $270 million and $440 million across the affected businesses and their supply partners, which is a stark reminder of just how vulnerable food and retail supply chains have become. For M&S, the impact was particularly severe. The retailer expects a $300 million hit to operating profits, only partially offset by insurance claims, a seismic financial blow that also sent shockwaves through its digital operations and brand reputation. But the damage has gone far beyond the balance sheet. Online services were suspended for weeks, leaving customers unable to place orders, collect parcels, or access loyalty discounts. And behind the scenes, teams were forced to revert to pen and paper systems to manage core food supply operations. As ordering systems ground to a halt, shelves went empty, loyalty schemes froze, and perhaps most damaging of all, customers' trust took a significant hit. The Co-op, meanwhile, demonstrated greater operational resilience. While it was too targeted, advanced detection systems and strong network segregation limited the scale of the disruption. So we'll start, as we always do, with an opening statement, and this is for both of you. We've seen a rise in the number of cyber attacks on food businesses in the past few years, as we've just demonstrated with Co-op and M&S, and the complexity of these schemes is only increasingly. In your view, why is our sector becoming such an attractive target, and do you think businesses are taking threats seriously enough?
I think that's a really heavy question. Looking at the food industry, so bearing in mind my background has been regulated industries, constructions, insurances, and pharmaceutical companies, I think with food, it's very different. It's critical infrastructure. We need it to survive as humans. I don't think that's wrong to say. So to damage the food industry has a very real and seen impact. So cyber criminals, when we look at them, they're not kids sitting behind laptops. They're very smart people that are doing it based off ego or based off disruption. Most of the time, the money is an added bonus. It's not there for, they're not, that's not their main motive. It's to create disruption. The biggest disruption that we've seen, like you said, with M&S is shelves empty. And they can claim that as their own. So I think when we're talking about the food industry, it's visible. You can see empty shelves. You can see news articles. You can see the impact of what they're doing. So I think they unfortunately have a taste for it. That taste is going to grow. And we're going to see it more and more, especially with the political climates as they are. Hitting critical infrastructure is key to a lot of different disruptive organizations that want to get into the heart of civilization, which sounds quite very open and vague. But I think looking at the second point, are we doing enough? Probably not. We'll look at Co-op. They are very much towards the banking side of things. They've got very strong safeguards. They've segregated, as you said, their networks. M&S has segregated to a degree. So when we look at their banking, it's offshore. It's completely separate to the M&S structure as a whole. So where it comes to how they structure their IT, their information security, may be very different. And then we look at their supply chain. So who is it impacted? How has that worked? Did they do enough? Probably not. What lessons can we learn from them? I think as an organization, or at least food organizations, they're very much acquisitive. So they buy smaller businesses that function independently. They then come into a conglomerate, or they come into several different versions of businesses that are all stitched together. That creates a weakness and vulnerability that can be exploited very quickly. And then you add the additional financial pressure to say, your supply chain's been hit, now pay us 25 million. Great. I'm going to add some urgency to that. You're also going to see empty shelves, your contracts are going to be null and void, you're going to have real life quick impact from a very small thing that could just be somebody sending an email or not following a process. So I think it's a really large question. The food industry as a whole is not as up to date as, you know, a technical company or something that is very much at the forefront, like a SaaS implementer that's going to have all of these safeguards. But I think we're at a point now where it's going to be consistent, it's going to be common, and it's going to be something that we need to prepare for.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think the other side of it is looking at, there is a high level cybercrime, but then also the availability of technology is now getting down to a much lower level where, from our point of view, fraudsters, organized crime groups can use technology fairly easily now to make industries such as food a vulnerable area, because they might see it as easier than the more traditional areas for criminality, such as, you know, theft of technology or theft or supplying drugs, whereas it might be easier to shift, you know, meat or cheese or dairy products than it is to move drugs. So using that technology does make the food industry probably a more potential victim than it ever has been before. And exactly like you said, it's that risk of it separating out from the food industry maybe not being up to date on technology, but then equally it's who holds the responsibility in a food business for managing cybercrime and managing cyber risks, because the cybercrime element might be right at the top of a business, but then the risk of someone using technology to commit a food crime might go down to the technical manager who might not know anything about technology. And we don't require them to know anything about technology. It's a very big question.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately, yeah, I think there's, it's just about joining up the dots with where the risks are. So it does fall into basic risk assessment, which technical managers, food safety managers do know a lot about, but it's the subject area where they might not be up to date on.
Brilliant. Thank you both very much. Ben mentioned about the kind of availability of technology and how easily people can now access that. And I think this brings us really nicely onto AI. So AI is becoming a much bigger thing for every industry. I mean, we're sat in the AI hub now that we use for consumer research. And increasingly, we're having more cloud-based systems where stuff's saved in the ether somewhere instead of being on a physical hard drive. We've got integrated data platforms and they're really critical to how we operate. So how do we embrace all of those new technologies, improve efficiency, but not open ourselves up to cyber vulnerabilities?
I love your questions. They're like, how do you fix everything all at once? Give me the answer. So I think one of the things we need to really consider, and this is not just a technology buzzword, is security by design. So a lot of companies, not specifically food, will create their own software. They will build applications. They have their own development areas. They may even have legacy systems, which they then in turn will hybrid and create their own. So security by design means that every stage of that development or software development lifecycle is completely managed. So it's not all down to users and business requirements. It's building that out to say, we need role-based access. We need segregated different areas to build, to deploy, to develop. Where we talk about AI, I love the topic because it feels like we're living in the Matrix, but not quite there yet. So the possibility of Minority Report is already happening, right? We're seeing that there's AI in every aspect of our lives. Even mobile phone manufacturers are putting it straight into your phones. So the availability of AI, the availability of data makes it far more important that we look at it, not just from a professional perspective. It's how do we protect ourselves outside of work? I feel like I'm losing track of your question. Am I slightly? But I think what we need to really understand is from an architecture perspective, security by design is something that we need to embed completely. We also need more sophisticated monitoring. So real live threat detection that is actually real time as well. So where it comes to the IT team seeing alerts, you do get alert fatigue. You will have infrastructure teams that will consistently see alerts and that just becomes white noise. We need sophisticated AI to support us. We need to be on the front foot of it, but we cannot let that hinder where we're trying to go. So I think to summarize, we'll innovate, secure, and sustain. So innovate with AI, secure every application, every product, every software, every development, and then sustain that growth. But it needs to be a technology-focused sustain with people making those decisions and people making the choices of how it will work for them.
Yeah, I think that's it's such a big question on the AI stuff, and it goes definitely beyond my kind of background and the kind of work we do, but we're seeing AI as both a benefit and a threat. You know, there are lots of benefits to AI in crime prevention because you can horizon scan so much faster than you ever could. There are risks with that. You're always going to have the human element to go, are any of these threats actually relevant to my business? Or am I seeing the same threat repeated a million times because it's just doing rounds on 10 different reports? So, but there's definitely benefits to AI, but the risks are definitely out there about how much can you trust anymore about what you see? What can you believe? Because when AI starts to have the ability to mask our voices or our faces or create deep fakes or, you know, suddenly the food industry has always been based on the human element, the trust, the buyer making a connection at a trade show and meeting someone new and going, oh yes, I will, you know, sell you £50,000 worth of product next week. And it can be that quick and that instant on that higher level of money and risk. And so knowing that that person that you met at that trade show is the person emailing you or phoning you or even Teams messaging you now because of AI, how do you trust it? And what are your controls in your business to go, well, how do I know what I'm looking at anymore? And that goes down to a really good threat analysis system, vulnerability assessment, risk assessments, all those kind of things have to be designed now considering AI. It's no longer just a theory. It's no longer just, oh, well, AI might do this or it might do that. You have to be putting it into practice as a threat, but also not being too scared of it, not to go, well, there are definitely benefits. It's a bit of a mixed bag, isn't it?
And I think that's really interesting because most of the time, IT, or at least technical teams, are seen as blockers, right? We don't want you to do this. We don't want you to access this. That is ridiculous. So we need to be the enablers of those bits of technology.
Can I say on that blocking point that when I was doing the research for this episode, so many websites were blocked by our IT system. So thank you, Helpdesk.
Hopefully they're unblocked.
To research at home. No.
But that's the thing, right? Everyone, whenever you want to speak to an IT person, most of the time you will picture the IT crowd or computer says no. And it's usually a mixture of the two that you'll get. And what we fail to do as IT people is say, we are here as a supportive service to enable the business. So you can go meet your suppliers. You can go have wonderful conversations. You can have your dinners. That's fine. But let's make sure that who you're emailing is a safe domain. Let's make sure that who's on the Teams chat is the people that have been allowed through the Teams chat. The invites that you get are the right people and that we have identity and access management. So I think it's pivoting from IT being there to keep the lights on to IT enabling businesses to grow. We don't want to stop that growth. We need the budget. Like, we don't want to stop that growth at all. But it's how do we then make sure that from the business side of things, that we are the enablers of that. We're coming to you to say, we have an AI solution. Will this help? But yes, how will that help? How do we then integrate that into the rest of the business? So I think there's really good points, like you said, with AI, but it's making sure that we enable it rather than block it.
Brilliant. Thank you both. You both talked there about kind of trust and the element of human error specifically. And I think when it comes to IT, we talk a lot about systems and firewalls. And a lot of these high-profile breaches just start with that simple human error, like a click of a phishing email, which more so now when phishing emails might come from somebody you have spoken to and somebody you have trusted or appear to have come from that person. But given the scale of the impact that single mistake can have in a business, what more should we be doing to build a culture of cyber awareness?
I think it's about building it into the plans. It's always got to be within your threat assessments if you have them. But equally, it's about training. It's no different to any other risk as part of a resiliency plan that you might have in a business. It's you know, if you look at food safety, any kind of food, you know, everything has an SOP and a training scenario behind it, and production managers looking at their watch whilst you're taking all their team out to do more training. But it's important, and it's making sure that anyone who has the power to buy a product or accept something in at the back door of a business or, you know, make any kind of deal in business understands what the risks are and has regular training on how to spot the risks. And it goes back to culture. Again, these are all terms that are really common in food and fraud and IT. They all overlap anyway, but we've put them into silos, I think. But they're not. And it's about your culture. If someone sees something a bit dodgy at Goods Inn, they should report it. If someone sees an email that looks a little bit weird, they should report it. Fitting it all into, instead of saying that's food safety culture and that's cyber culture and, you know, that's health and safety culture. It's just the culture of your business. It's just you see something weird, report it. Even if you don't necessarily know who to, you raise it up and someone should be able to manage it. And that is part of any kind of prevention plan, whether it's fraud prevention, cybercrime prevention, whatever it is, it should be hand in hand with your planning.
Yeah, and I think culture is one of those things that's a lifetime's work to change completely. But the training, 100% agree, we definitely need more training. I think once a year is nowhere near enough. I will forget the minute I've finished it. So regular, consistent training is definitely something that a lot of organizations need to hound people with, but just enough to make it fun and relevant. I think when it comes to cyber training, I did ours very recently, it's very heavy and it's almost like a full hour of somebody talking at you, which is lovely and great, but that information for somebody that's non-technical is a lot to take in, and we can't expect people who are experts in their own field to also be experts in ours. So we need to make it digestible, food pun. We need to make it easy to understand and we need to make it fun. But I think one of the things that has been consistent throughout my career, from even working on an IT service desk, one of the best InfoSec guys I worked with, he pointed at me and he said, "You're the biggest security risk in our business." And I took that really personally. I was like, "I've locked my screen. I don't know what you're talking about." But he said, "It's people. People are the biggest security asset and the biggest security risk. So if we don't train our people, we don't teach our people, we don't tell them how to not give somebody the key to the front door, then we are at a loss completely." So I think the people are the main parts of any kind of cybersecurity in sort of strategy that we put forward. The other part of it is making sure it's from top down. So it needs to come at a board level. It needs buy-in, but then it's the translation of what our operational IT team see to board speak. How do we make them understand? How do we make them see that this is not just something that happens to other companies? We are very much at the same threat. We're at the same risk, even if not more, because we don't have that at the moment. Not to say that Oscar Mayer doesn't, but in most food organizations, from what I've heard in the industry, cyber security technology investment is not where it would be at any other organization. I think you touched on deepfakes earlier. There was a company, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, Arve Arup. I'm going to go with that. They had a senior financial analyst who had a Teams call with their CFO, released 25 million into a different organization based off that Teams call. That Teams call was a deep fake. So this is very real. It's very upfront. It's a UK-based organization that had a global footprint. So it's not something that is just segregated to other areas. It is very much real and in our world, and we need to be able to understand that and work with it and understand how to combat it as well.
Wow. I can't believe that you've just gone and listened. Yep. That's insane.
I mean, if the CFO calls you and says, "Here you go, we've got a new business, give us 25 million, you just go, "Okay, cool." But it's following up with an email. Like, you've asked me to do this. Yeah. Is this the right thing? Is this the right company? And that's where slight prevention could have happened. But I think coming back to culture, like you said, food industry, it's very much handshakes. It's, I know that person, the human trust is already there. They would have had that already.
But it's speed as well. Yeah. Speed is, you have plans and you have training and you have the processes, double checking it, taking half an hour, half a day to check something so that it fits correctly in your plan is so important. And sometimes that might not feel doable for a business. There might be pressure. And that's, you said, has to come from the top. In fraud prevention, talk a lot about tone from the top. Everything has to come from the top. And if the culture is, "I've told you to do it, you have to do it now," it means that there is now an added risk that isn't in any of your risk assessments. It's that I've got to do this. And sometimes that can happen not because of poor culture, but from things like commodity shortages. You know, "We need to approve this new supplier. Can you set it up?" "Well, okay, but I've never met that supplier. I haven't talked to them. What does my SOP, what does my procedure say I have to do before I set up a new supplier? And okay, you need that now because we're going to short product. but which is worth more? Shorting the product today or having a serious risk of cybercrime or food crime or something like that? And it's thinking your procedures are there for a reason and using them to protect yourself, even when it feels counterintuitive. And I think that's, yeah, like you said, the tone of top, it has to come from the top down, that you're trusted to make your own decisions. And if someone doesn't feel right, double check, send that follow-up email, have that phone call directly with them, see them. If you're there in the office, knock on their door, double check that they're the one that's asked you to do that.
Yeah. Can I just build on that?
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that you mentioned is the culture side of it. And then when you came back, I think you said something about if you see something weird, report it.
Yeah.
And it's how do you build that culture? Because you might see something weird and just think, okay, that's weird, and move on. But it's moving that culture from that's weird, now I've got to report it. And it brings it back to cybersecurity is not just an IT function. It is not something that just sits within a small section of IT. It's the responsibility of everyone in an organization to own their processes, to own their accountability, and to be able to say that something is wrong, therefore I need to follow a process. So I think the culture shift also needs to happen, that data management and system management is not just an IT function, it is the responsibility of everyone that uses the systems, software, or platforms.
Brilliant, thank you. And that leads us nicely as well. So in the introduction, we spoke about HACCP, TACCP, VACCP, and we talked about technical becoming kind of like the expert in HACCP and then having VACCP and TACCP plans forced onto them and the need to rethink who owns that. So Soraya, you've just said, obviously it's everybody's responsibility, but from a kind of prevention planning and risk assessment perspective, where does it sit and who should own the digital defence?
Yeah, so I think for us, it's really interesting. So in my team in the National Food Crime Unit, we do a lot of, we offer free assessments for businesses to come to us and we'll review their food crime prevention policies and strategies. And what we see a lot is that TACCPs and VACCPs are kind of seen as the Holy Grail. Well, I've got my TACCP plan, I've got my VACCP plan. That means that I'm protected. That means that I've got it. And sometimes, yes, that's true. But it's all the policies around that that need to be owned by different people. And so the ownership of it is a bit of a tricky question because it's more about the person writing it doesn't actually have to know the detail of every single little part of it, as long as you've got a good team. Now, we're all in the food industry, you're always taught that in HACCP. You've got to have a working HACCP team, and it's got to have your engineer, and it's got to have your production manager, and it's got to have, you know, everyone who might be involved, and preferably someone off the shop floor or a supervisor. You know, how involved they get depends on your company, your size of your company, your resources, lots of different things. But the best performing companies for a HACCP have a properly multifunctional HACCP team. Since VACCP and TACCP came along, are those teams as multifunctionary as a HACCP team? Do they include the IT teams? Do they include whoever owns your bribery and corruption policy? And I think that's what we see a lot, is because if bribery and corruption is probably a really good one, because that's where you might have a lot of risks coming from, you know, cybercrime or just lots of other risks coming in. There will be a gift register in a business. Most businesses, especially larger ones, will have to have a gift register. But there will also be someone in your business who trends that, reviews that data, says if there are any unusual spikes, anything that looks odd, you know, very high-level gifts. There will be someone in a business reviewing all of this data. That person should be in your vulnerability or your threat assessment team because they already have the data you need. And I think that's the thing. It's especially for bigger companies. We work with a lot of small companies as well where it's a lot harder because it is often the owner having to wear lots and lots of hats. And that's where the risk is really high. And that's where you have to kind of make sure that person does have a level of understanding of everything. But in bigger companies, you shouldn't need to. You should have teams who already manage fraud, prevention, risks, all those kind of ideas. I think with threat assessment and vulnerability assessment, it's not necessarily about, well, technical own it, so it's now their thing. All technical are doing are writing a risk assessment. And that risk assessment doesn't have to be called TASSUP or VASSUP. It could be just called a fraud prevention plan and the associated risk assessment. It could be, you know, IT teams will have their own risk assessments. They will have their, and they'll call it different things. So it's not worrying about what you call it. It's more worrying about how often is it reviewed? What are the real life threats? And not necessarily just going by, well, here are all the countries that I buy from. Here are the risks with those countries. You know, here are my key codes. Here are, you know, there might be a good starting point, but speak to the people who deal with it day to day. Speak to whoever manages your fraud policies. Speak to whoever manages your IT security, because they might come up with something that you've never thought of.
Definitely. And I'm going to pretend to know what HACCP and VASSUP are. So,
just risk assessments. HACCP is food safety risk assessment. VASSUP is vulnerability, so it's where you're buying a commodity from. And TASSUP is threat, so physically, security, people getting in, IT systems, all those kind of things. They're just different risk assessments that the food industry uses. So.
And I think that's really interesting, talking about having it in several different places, because very recently I've been through the same experience where there's a risk register and there's another one. And that's where it comes to not necessarily centralization, because I understand a lot of businesses do work independently. There's decentralized functions. There is a lot of movement that happens in the food industry. So they do need to be decentralized. But where it comes to owning an enterprise, having an enterprise architecture function, or at least the understanding of what enterprise architecture is, gives you that centralized risk register. So we might have something that sits within a site that's, you know, in Kuala Lumpur, for example. I'm not saying that we're going Kuala Lumpur, but that would be fun. We might have a site that's in London and another one that's in Wrexham, where we are today. So it's, where are all of these people? Who are our subject matter experts? How is that interfunctional or cross-functional teams working? And then how do we make sure that they're collaborating? So when you're talking about reviews, do we do that quarterly? Is this part of our business planning that we do at the end of the year? How do we then make sure that these people who have identified threats and risks are listened to, and we've at least got mitigating plans against them? So from an IT perspective and looking at it zooming out, I think enterprise architecture is something that a lot of organizations don't have in its formal capacity, and they don't need to, but it gives an understanding of what's there, and you can protect what's there. You can't protect what you don't know. So where it comes to documenting, big fan of documentation. I've got a million notes in front of me. Love documentation. It gives us something to work with. We can't work with something from an IT perspective to go, oh, that might be a problem. Great. What kind of problem? How does that work?
Yeah. And you've just made me think of something really important there, is terminology. We are here speaking two different languages. Yeah. And that's the biggest barrier to a lot of this about working together when you're doing your threat assessments and things like that, is maybe areas don't want to talk because they don't know they're talking about the same thing. Is a TASSUP plan the same as a risk register? All of these things that you might just be using different words, so you don't know that someone else in your business already looks after this stuff. So you might have to go really basic and go, does anyone look after this? Who looks after password control? Who looks after locks? Who looks after this? Because they might not understand. If you say, I am writing my threat analysis document, do you have any critical control points in this area? That's not going to mean anything to you, is it?
I mean, it means nothing to me at all. But if you said something completely different, like I've got a risk register and there's like 12 different threats and vulnerabilities we've identified, have we got any incident plans? Love that. I can work with that. And I think that's where a lexicon is really helpful. And that comes back down to data management. So being able to speak the same language is so important to organizations that it creates that friction. So really good example, reporting between HR and finance teams, pretty much the same in some aspects, and I don't want to get slaughtered by our HR and finance teams, but where it comes to people metrics or labor costs, it's the same ice cream in different flavors. I don't know why I'm going with food puns, but it's the same ice cream. Like, it's people, but it's the way we cut and slice that information and how we disseminate that to people is totally different. So what you're saying makes complete sense in context. But if you came to me and said, have you got a thrass up, thrass up? No idea. No idea what that is. No, I don't. But if you said, is there a risk register? Sure. Let me share it with you. Have at it. There's no problem with that. So I think lexicon, terminology, but that again comes back down to culture.
Yeah.
And it's making an open culture where you can have these conversations. And I don't know why people are really afraid to look stupid in a conversation. And they don't want to say they don't know. Like, and it's really weird because you want to be able to talk to people. And to do that, you have to understand what they're saying. And creating a culture where somebody can just say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Explain it to me like I don't have a brain in my head today. That's where we need to get to, where it's an even playing field. We're all working towards the same goal to make profit. We are not in a charity. To do that, we need to work together. And to work together, we need to know what we're talking about.
I think, Ben, you touched on it when you said that a lot of the smaller businesses have maybe got an owner wearing lots of different hats. So they might be looking at, maybe one day they're looking at, where are the lorries going? The next day they're looking at, what ingredients do I need to order and what plan are we doing on the production floor? And I think some businesses may see the addition of things like VASSUP and TASSUP into BRCGS standard, for example, as extra legwork, another tick box. And the plans are written then to conform to the standard and what the standard is asking you. So have you got a plan? Have you got a multidisciplinary team? Has it been reviewed in the last year? That's typically what BRC are going to ask when they knock on your door, isn't it? And I think, how can we evolve quicker as an industry than the threats themselves? Because we'll get a new BRCGS standard every 3, 4, 5 years, but we're seeing new attacks and different threats every minute, every second. So how can the frameworks keep pace?
It's an interesting one, because I don't think it's necessarily about the frameworks keeping pace, because they are food safety standards and that they have to make sure that they're written in a way to make sure that food safety controls are in place. And now that does include threat and vulnerability, because food crime, adulteration, substitution, theft, they can all affect food safety. However, once they're in there and once it says have a plan, it's very much down to your business to decide how you do that plan. You look at the clauses in BRCGS or even SALSA or any of the standards, and they are talking about having your plans, having your risk assessments. How you choose to do that and what you choose as your threats and your risks and your vulnerabilities and your actions are completely up to you as a business. And it goes back to the culture that we've been talking about. It's yes, it can be tempting to use it as a tick box, but it's going beyond that and searching out, what do I need to do to protect my business? We do a lot of training. So we've done training sessions with SALSA where they've hosted and businesses could come, and we'll run a session on a mock food fraud incident so that people can understand what might happen, what you can do to put in food fraud prevention into your businesses. And it's those extra steps beyond just okay, I have my risk assessment, because that's kind of a... You should have that anyway, with or without it being in a standard. The standard is great from our point of view, because it means that people are more aware of having these kind of risk assessments, understanding threat analysis that wasn't known about 5, 10, 15 years ago. But like I said, it's an extra string to add to the bow of someone in a business. So I think the main thing is use every resource available. Find whatever resource is relevant to you on whatever you think is the risk. If it's cybercrime, look up cybercrime prevention. Teach it. And I get that people will have limited time, limited budgets, but it's working out, well, my risk assessment says that's high risk, so I'm going to put a little bit of time in to understand that a bit more. So yeah, I think it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things, what it says in the standards, because they will always write those standards to be at the top level to prevent food safety issues. How you then use the stuff you've built in, how you use your own policies is very much up to every business. They have to own that and use it, because you can audit and say they have a risk assessment, but that will change massively. I've been to sites that have two people working for them, you know, dairies that are absolutely tiny. And then I've been to huge multinational factories. You're not going to run them the same way. You're not going to have the same risk assessment, but they might be audited to the same standard, you know, and that's it. But the answers on their risk assessment will be very, very different. So it's just adapting it to your business. And I think that's because cyber risks are going to evolve so quickly. It's more about how you manage the threats and you manage your own risks and use all the resources available. There are lots of resources available to food businesses, and probably more available if you look outside of it to IT skills and stuff. There's probably an untapped resource there that people don't even know is out there.
Yeah, exactly. So I think smaller businesses are probably a bit more of a risk because it is one owner. That owner will probably have quite a large online footprint. They will probably have multiple different social media accounts. They will have people that would be able to identify them. So where it comes to identity theft, that is probably really high in a smaller business than it would be for something a bit larger. Not to say that it wouldn't happen in a large organization either, but the risk of it is probably far more prominent. What we, and I probably am going to be not very, what's the word? Quite controversial. Managed service providers exist. So you can outsource IT if that is something that you need to do. There are people that understand the terminology, the concepts, the complexities that come with owning systems, software, and implementations that will deal with the harder facts and provide you with the information that you need. Not everyone needs to be an IT expert when it comes to cybercrime. They just need to know how to not give that key to somebody else. So really simply, are your passwords your kids' date of birth with an exclamation mark with the name in it? Scrolling through a couple of different social media accounts, you could probably find out how old the kid is and what the name is and what the date of birth is. Very simple. And it's things like that where smaller organizations need to think differently about how they manage their online footprint, what they deliver out as a public image, and then how do they make sure they protect that as they grow bigger and bigger. And if they need to outsource IT, fine, do it. If you've got the budget to do it, absolutely, that is the right thing for you to do. But if it's an organization like Oscar Mayer, where we have an IT team, we have so many different places that all of this information will go to, it's how do we make sure everyone understands what the policy is? How do we make sure that these policies aren't just shelfware and it's sitting somewhere that's just, you know, gathering dust? We need to make sure it's embedded. And again, take to hand more on about culture, but it's embedding that culture. So new joiners, do they get all the information security training? Do they understand that as part of our culture, we lock screens when we move away? Is that something that is present, prevalent, and completely understood that it's abnormal to see somebody not do it? And it's building that from the top down again, I guess.
Brilliant. Thank you both so much. So we have a little tradition where once we've finished the main debate, we move into rapid fire. So these are just gut reaction. Don't think about it too much. A word or a sentence at most. So I've got a couple of rapid fires. So Ben, cybersecurity is now as critical as HACCP, yes or no?
No, but it's almost as important because it leads into bigger risks. If you fail on cybersecurity, you can't do anything. If you fail on HACCP, you know, you could kill someone. It's two very different risks, but very high level risks that have managed alongside each other.
Okay, Soraya, if a ransomware demand landed on your desk tomorrow, do you think most food businesses would pay it?
Wait, are you saying am I going to pay it or are other people going to pay it? I'm not paying.
Not you personally.
I would not be paying, but most businesses would pay it.
Ben, biggest weak spot, outdated systems, third-party suppliers or human error?
I think third-party suppliers, because you have to understand who you're trading with.
Do you believe AI will become our greatest defence or our biggest risk?
I think both.
For both of you, right now, are food businesses underestimating cyber risk, yes or no?
Should we say yes, yes. together?
Ben, if cybersecurity was a ready meal, would we describe it as best before, used by, or past its date?
I think used by, because you need to, eventually it's going to become dangerous.
And to finish off, would you trust AI to spot a phishing scam faster than your own finance team?
Oh, that's a horrible question. And I hope finance don't listen. I want to say yes, but heavily caveat, phishing scams have gotten far more sophisticated than grammar errors. So I want to say yes, because AI can do the full end-to-end, whereas finance can just look at one thing. Sorry, finance.
Nice caveat. That's fine. I don't think finance listen anyway. Thank you very much. So we've got a closing question. And I think it's probably culminates most of what we've spoken about today. But as cyber threats evolve and technologies like AI reshape how we work, what is the one most important thing the food industry must do now to protect systems, supply chains, and ultimately the consumer trust?
I think from my point of view, it's just have working risk assessments that are regularly updated. That's the most important part, is you've got to understand your risk. You've got to understand where your vulnerabilities are, but you can't assume that the risks from 6 months ago are still the risks now. So it's not just about having the plans, having the fraud prevention schemes, having the cybercrime risk assessments, having even food safety risk assessments. It's about updating them regularly, and that will does use resource, but things are moving quicker than they ever have. So is a once a year update suitable? It might be for some businesses, but probably not for a lot now. So yeah, have the risk assessments, but really, really spend time looking at them and understanding what your risks are and what you're doing about them.
So I think having a cybersecurity strategy or an IT strategy alongside a business strategy. It needs to be integrated, it needs to be embedded, and it needs to come from the top. We talked a lot about culture. Culture is a massive prevention where it comes to raising, understanding, and arming people with the right information. Training, huge, huge helper, but is useless without the right systems and processes in place. So IT strategy, digital strategy, marrying with a business strategy to then give people the understanding of what it is that we're dealing with. I think, again, it all comes from the top, and it needs to be understood that cybersecurity is not just an IT function. It is the responsibility of every person in an organization. And it's not something that you should just leave at work. Take it home with you and understand that what you're doing on social media or what you're putting out on the internet is all scrapable, traceable, and fully usable by anyone that has any linkage to your information across anywhere. So I think the thing that I would want people to take away from this is protect what you can protect, prepare for whatever we need to, and really provide people with the training and understanding that they need.
Have we got any audience questions? Do you want the microphone, David?
Yeah, of course.
Can you introduce yourself as well, please?
Oh, yeah. So I'm David Clack, a Group Supplier Approval Manager and Integrity Lead. Just a general question, really. I suppose when you think of sort of food fraud, we always sort of think of small and medium size enterprises to be a bigger risk, as you said, Ben, because of the resources, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the M&S, particularly in the co-op instance, were, you know, on the surface of it, quite a surprise, you know, that a business of that size, that could happen to. So it's just whether there was a view, whether there were any particular sectors of the supply chain considered to be more vulnerable, more targeted.
I think from my point of view, you know, the National Food Crime Unit, we publish our own control strategy where we say which commodities are more at risk and that we're looking at the moment to develop more understanding of them. And they are usually kind of, you know, what you'd normally know from risk assessments in terms of premium meat products, you know, premiumization of meat as a risk of misrepresentation, things like honey and olive oil and those kind of areas that, that are higher risk in terms of commodities. And I think that's, ultimately, it goes back to what we said earlier. It's about who you're working with. It's probably the biggest risk is knowing who you're actually dealing with and who they are. And we've talked a lot about it's getting easier to fake that. And so I think that's the biggest risk is just knowing who you're dealing with now across any size of business, because, you know, the vulnerabilities, and like you said, small businesses are at risk, but using a food fraud example, horse meat, which is where the NFCU was born, the National Food Crime Unit was created out of horse meat and the hearings afterwards and all the information afterwards, you know, that affected lots of big companies. And that was through the complex nature of the food supply chain. And I suppose that's it. With a complex nature, do you know who you're getting everything from all the way through the system? Traceability is really good, but equally, there will always be vulnerabilities in it. So yeah, it goes back to the biggest risk is probably knowing who you're dealing with all the way through your chain.
This is Brittany, social media digital marketing person. Just what you were saying, Soraya, about just on a personal brand, you know, protecting your own socials and stuff. Because I know my TikTok is public and things like that. I don't go on there like, hey, today's my birthday. We have so much information out there on the internet right now that anybody could just go and find out probably anything about you and then pretend to be you. It's just so easy.
Absolutely. Like we were talking about earlier, you can start business online. And with the right information, you could have a birthday post. Yeah. I now know your birthday. There is ways that people, really smart, intelligent people who unfortunately have got the wrong end of where they want to be legally, will be able to get into systems. There is a really good website called Have I Been Pwned, which will tell you if your email address has been involved in any kind of data breach, which is really interesting to see. So MyFitnessPal had one and my email address was leaked. I was like, well, lovely. Love that I found that out, but not great that they've had one. So it's about understanding what you put out on the internet. And I feel really old fashioned for saying this because I remember back in the day in the 90s, you'd hear, don't put everything on the internet because people will know where you are. Whereas now we're like, it's my birthday. This is my house. Look at my child. Here's my car. But we don't think about it twice now at all. But it's understanding that what you put out there is out there forever. There is internet archives. People can find out what they want whenever they want. Unfortunately, I don't do social media because understanding what that can be used for in the most negative ways is just really alarming, but also gives you an idea of how much people are willing to put out there that makes it easier. So I think it's understanding that, yes, cybersecurity is a very scary business threat, but when it comes to opening up a bank account or digital fraud where people are taking credit card information, somebody could open an Amex in your name. Great, that's just happened. And it's understanding that that's based off information that they could very easily find.
Maybe this is why I have such a hard time getting people to be in our socials on our company stuff, because people are like, I don't want any of my information out there, but I do promise I'm not going to put any personal information out there. But
yeah.
But yeah, I do know that that is one reason I have a hard time getting people to be on camera, because, you know, a lot of people are aware of people out there looking, people that you don't know, or who knows, if someone's got a stalker, they can easily find out, oh, this is where they work now, so I can find that. So in my job, I have a little bit of a difficulty because people are very aware of the threat.
But there are ways to do it safely, right?
Yeah.
There are ways. You can create really strong passwords using a password manager rather than your child's date of birth and name with an exclamation mark.
I've started doing that where it's all the crazy letters, exactly, and everything. Yeah.
So that's one way of doing it. You know, posting something 3 weeks after it happened, fine. Yes. Do it then. Like, don't let people know you're on holiday and your house is empty and you've got a Maserati sitting out front. Come on. Let's yeah, not do those things.
Absolutely. Last time I went on holiday, I posted it all when I came back, all of my content and stuff. Okay, I'm just going on and on now.
David has more questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was just going to agree with the panel really in terms of, I think certainly from a supplier perspective and us visiting sort of lots of our suppliers, I think it is a good point that too often I would say the sort of risk assessment around this sort of subject area is unfortunately, it's a piece of paper because BRC require it. And I totally agree, even from a, you know, from a due diligence perspective, from our perspective, whether we are putting enough emphasis, you know, in this sort of subject area, really in terms of the detail and being a live, living system.
Yeah, I think the trick is trying to get out of the food safety mindset sometimes and allowing people from other departments to have a really good input into it. And sometimes it may be tricky to have that initial discussion because we talked about the language issues of using different terminology. But there will be a lot of knowledge out there about these risks that aren't going to come from food safety training. They're going to come from fraud prevention training. They're going to come from cybersecurity training. They're going to come from places where a technical manager wouldn't necessarily have that background or need that background. And that's the important bit. It's not about making one person do all of it. It's about letting the risk assessment tell you who needs to manage the risk. Just like you do with everything else. You don't have, ideally, you don't have the technical manager fixing the metal detector. I know it happens, been there. But ideally, you wouldn't have that happen. You would have your engineer go and do it, because that's the subject matter expert. So in the same way, supplier assurance and supplier management comes under your fraud prevention risk, comes under your asset plan. But should that risk be managed by the food safety team or an integrity team, or are some of those risks actually held by, you know, IT, HR, finance? Use what you've got. Don't make one person be everything in fraud prevention or crime prevention in a business, because that person is then technically a risk that you then have to put in your risk assessment and have someone else tell you what you do about that risk of that person.
Exactly. And I think the single point of failure there is massive, because where you're talking about multifunctional people inputting into one document, that's a risk in itself, because it's how many versions of this document have we had? Is this the final version? Has it been overwritten? So I think having, I don't know if there's too many committees, but some kind of centralized place where these people will meet, have the conversation, understand that there's a subject matter expert from each functional area. They may not be relevant, but there might be something that is an interdependency. And we talked about enterprise architecture earlier, but one of the biggest key drivers of enterprise architecture is looking at interdependencies across each different business function or cross-section of an organization. So we look at everything. It's called a BDAT. So you look at the business, the data, the applications, and the technology. How does the business process work, and how many other people are involved in that? So it's really going back to, you can't protect what you can't see. And if you can't see that other people are involved, you can't protect those parts of the business. So having a huge blueprint or a horse blanket of, these are the people that are involved in this particular function, and they are then required to provide an input and then be accountable, is probably somewhere that I think that could go.
I think the other thing I would say is sort of in terms of sort of thinking about the UK industry more in terms of, you know, we've got things like sort of FIN, you know, the Food Industry Intelligence Network, which is absolutely fantastic organisation for obviously sharing data on food fraud, and the whole industry learns from that. It's been fantastic. And it'll be interesting to see if it's sort of for this subject area, whether it be that organisation or something else.
Yeah, and that's it. There's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of resources out there now for all these different bits of it. That there are, I think the next step would be food businesses looking wider at resources around fraud prevention, crime prevention, cybercrime prevention, and going a bit out of the bubble of what's available just in the food space. But obviously, you know, the NFCU, we offer training, we offer assessments, we offer free online tools. FIN, like you said, they've got all the data for food adulteration and food crime in terms of sampling data. and they've just launched a small medium enterprise hub where now you can sign up for free. So smaller businesses can get a quarterly summary of where the risks are so that they can use that to inform their risk assessments to aid them, you know, using big data in a nice, simple fashion that they can say, okay, these are the commodities I need to look at. Do I use any of these? They go in my risk assessment. So yeah, a lot of it's about keeping an eye out on what's available and knowing what is available from who. And yeah, I think the cybercrime element is probably going to be built into other training in the future as well. I know I've seen a few bits about building that kind of element into training sessions, and there's been some discussions about that. It's probably the next step, really, about going beyond the risk assessment and into the training of kind of protecting your company through your individuals.
Yeah, because I guess as an industry, when these things happen, like the M&S, isn't it, is trying to get the learnings for the industry, isn't it? Because obviously, if it can happen to sort of a business like that, then yeah, it's good to know.
Definitely, and I think it's one of those things that people, especially in the cyberspace, will go, it will never happen to us. We're fine. It's never going to happen. But it's creating those disaster recovery and business continuity plans of, okay, what's the worst possible outcome for us and how can we mitigate that? Or do we understand what we currently look like so that we can create some kind of future planning if this does happen? Or what's our recovery point? So at what point will we be at a loss if we don't recover? Or how quickly and agilely? That's not a word. How quickly and agile can we switch production lines, for example? Can we mobilize our people really quickly to stop producing one item because that supply chain is completely down? Now we need to move to a different product. So it's really quite an intense, broad space.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to, again, what we talked about different departments. You've got crisis management. You just described crisis management. There will be a crisis management team in food safety. Is there one in IT? Is there one in HR? Is there one in finance? They're probably all working off similar ideas. And again, it's about sharing that knowledge and data across your business. If you've got a big business with lots of different teams, because you'll probably all have your own crisis management plans and you need to make sure that they don't all knock against each other or conflict if there is, you know, if a food business or an area of food is the risk and is exploited.
Thank you very much. Ben, before we finish, you've mentioned a couple of the resources that the National Food Crime Unit have got. So can you just signpost for people that might not be aware the website and so they know where to find it?
Yeah, sure. So it's www.food.gov.uk. If you go on there, there's a section where you can go to, it's in the About Us section, and then you can go to the National Food Crime Unit area of the website, and that then has a bit of information about what we offer. There is going to be, hopefully soon, a nice flyer summarizing all of the kind of offers that we have, tidying it up, making it look nice, pretty. My team are working hard on that at the moment, so hopefully that will be really soon. But yeah, it just talks about what we offer. And if you ever want to get directly in touch with us, there's the email address for my prevention team on there where you can get directly in touch with us. Also on that section is if you want to report a food crime anonymously, we do have a free phone number, and we also have a web portal to report any kind of suspicions on food crime, because for us that's as important as anything else, is knowing where there might be risks. And again, it's that thing that we talked about, if something looks weird, who do you report it to? If you don't want to report it within your business, you can come anonymously, confidentially, straight to the National Food Crime Unit. And you know, even if it turns out to be nothing, it's better to report it than not. So yeah, but the Food Standards Agency website has all of our details on there.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Ben, Soraya, thank you. You've both been excellent. And I hope this has given everybody something to chew on.